Alexander Hamilton, you know, that handsome guy on the $10 bill, at least for the moment he's on the $10 bill, is perhaps the most underappreciated member of our founding generation. Now hear me out on this. There are lots of important people and lots of people who deserve more recognition than they get, but Alexander Hamilton, he saved us from bankruptcy. He was our first Treasury Secretary. He did all sorts of incredible things at the Constitutional Convention, writing the Federalist Papers at the Department of the Treasury. Too bad that Aaron Burr eventually killed him in that nasty duel in New Jersey. But fortunately for all of us, Alexander Hamilton is enjoying a resurgence of interest. And today I'm going to speak with Julie Silverbrook, the Executive Director of Consource, all about what she calls Ham the Man.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter by 14.
I meet lots of interesting people through this show and through my related activities at Montpelier and with the We the People competition. And one of my favorites is a young woman. Her name is Julie Silverbrook. And at a very young, tender age out of law school, she has rocketed to the top of the constitutional literacy pyramid. And she is the executive director of a remarkably important organization out of Washington, D.C. called Consource, which we'll talk about here in just a moment. And she's also a big fan, as I am, of a fellow that I hope you've heard of named Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton is my personal nominee for perhaps the most underappreciated founder. As you'll see, Julie actually has a couple of other nominees there, but she agrees with me that it's a wonderful thing that we're now experiencing something that she refers to as the year of Ham the Man.
I'm Julie Silverbrook, Executive Director of the Constitutional Sources Project, and we are an educational nonprofit, and we educate anyone from a lawyer or judge to a student and teacher about U.S. constitutional history.
Which, of course, should be very familiar to anyone listening to the show, because you have been on the show, I'm thinking, several times before, haven't you?
That's correct, and it's always a blast every time I'm on.
It is a blast, and nonetheless, I always have to comment on this. You're just a young whippersnapper to be in charge of such a major, major thing. So that always just impresses the heck out of me. You're in your 20s. When I was in my 20s, I think I was probably drunk in a ditch somewhere half the time. and yet here you are running this whole thing. And tell me again, how did this happen? How did you get such a major job like this?
Yeah, so I have been involved with Consource since 2008 in a couple of different capacities, and had the opportunity after I graduated from law school to take over the nonprofit as executive director. And it's difficult to believe that that was almost 4 years ago, seems like yesterday. And it's been an absolute joy. I care very deeply about constitutional and civic literacy, and also making history accessible to the general public. And this job gives me the opportunity to do that.
Okay, for the uninitiated, just briefly, what does Consource do?
So our sort of central product, if you will, is consource.org, which is a free digital library of historical materials related to the creation, ratification, and amendment of the U.S. Constitution. We have tens of thousands of historical documents on our website, and we add new documents every year and have a couple of really exciting collections coming down the pike related to early state constitutions, women in the Constitution, the early Congresses and the Reconstruction period. So stay tuned. There's going to be some really great meaty content coming up online in the next couple of years. We also work to make these materials more understandable by a number of audiences. So we do a lot of teacher professional development. We develop free lesson plans for classroom use. We do public programming, and we also do legal programming like continuing legal education courses. And we're working on one now to mark the 240th anniversary of the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which is this year, 2016.
And of course, in constitutional interpretation, history is, if not determinative, it's extremely important. In fact, I believe it was Justice Kagan who not too long ago said that we're all originalists in the sense that all of us start with the text of the Constitution, and then the first thing we want to do after we've looked at the text is ask ourselves, okay, what's the context of that?
It's undeniably one of the more important tools in the toolbox for constitutional interpretation.
Absolutely. And what was significant about that, of course, is that Justice Kagan is sort of on the left of the court and probably wouldn't be described by most people as an originalist in the sense of being bound by history. But what she said makes sense. That's where you start. Okay, now even if you go beyond that and you want to talk about current trends and current mores and the changes in society over the last 200 some odd years, that's fine, but you always have to start and you always have to ground yourself in both the text and the context.
Absolutely.
What you're doing is extremely important. In fact, I understand that the work that you've done has been cited at the Supreme Court on more than one occasion, hasn't it?
I know for sure some of our documents have been cited in briefs, and I think we've been cited in at least one opinion, which is really exciting.
Okay, so that's who you are. That is what you do. What have you been up to lately? I mean, this is familiar to a lot of listeners already. So what are you currently doing? I recall hearing something recently in a conversation about Malaysia.
Yes, we participated in a program through the State Department's Young Southeast Asian Leadership Initiative, and we hosted a young Malaysian attorney who does constitutional literacy work over in Malaysia. And now we have the opportunity in March to go over to Malaysia and speak to people in their civil society about the constitutional literacy work that happens here in the United States. And Stuart, you're a part of that, and we're going to highlight all of the major players. We're going to get a better sense of the kind of work that they're doing and the opportunities for cultural exchange between our nation and theirs.
Of course, our subject today is a little bit more specific and a little bit closer to home. It's a fellow whom I often describe as the most overlooked of the founders. Now, that is probably not strictly speaking true. I mean, there are lots of members of our founding generation who are unjustifiably unknown. George Mason comes to mind, among many, many other important people. But to my mind, the person who is whose overlooking, if you will, is most egregious in terms of the difference between his importance on the one hand and how little he is known today is a guy by the name of Alexander Hamilton.
I might say that, you know, James Wilson of Pennsylvania is perhaps the most overlooked, but Hamilton historically has been overlooked, though he's having his moment.
Let's just remind everybody who Alex was, and I understand you've got a good thumbnail biography you can share with us.
Yeah, I mean, just in a couple of lines, Alexander Hamilton was the illegitimate son of a Scottish trader and a French woman who was cast out of her husband's home for her adulterous affair with James Hamilton. That's Alexander's father. Alexander was, when he was an infant, his father abandoned his family and they struggled to survive. But Alexander Hamilton was intelligent and hardworking. And at a very early age, about 11, he went to work as a clerk in a counting house and pressed the owner who worked to send young Hamilton to study in America. And he came to America at age 15 and he started studying at King's College, which is now Columbia. He entered politics early, wrote a couple of influential essays defending the move toward the war for independence. He, of course, fought by Washington's side during the Revolution. It was a delegate at the Constitutional Convention, helped ensure the ratification of the Constitution by writing 2/3 of the Federalist Papers. And of course, he saved the fledgling United States from financial ruin. And he is also known for dying in a tragic duel in Weehawken, New Jersey, when he went to battle with Aaron Burr.
Julie, that has to be one of the best thumbnail biographies I've ever heard. But it does point out to me that I really need to give a call to the author, Ron Chernow, who's written what is perhaps the definitive biography of Hamilton, and get him on the show and just devote an entire episode to really fleshing out that wonderful biography that you've just given. Just an amazing guy, absolutely amazing guy. And the particular reason we're talking about him now is that, as you said, he's having his moment. He is now Ham the Man?
Yes, that is a T-shirt that I purchased prior to going to see Hamilton, the eponymous, now Broadway musical. At the time I went to see it, it was off Broadway by Lin-Manuel Miranda, and it just seemed like an appropriate T-shirt to wear to such a show.
And you look fantastic in it, and I'll just tell listeners that we're going to post a picture of that on the Facebook page here very, very shortly, so everyone can check out the Ham the Man T-shirt. But we get a little ahead of ourselves. His moment, if I may say so, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, started about 10 years ago when Ron Chernow published that absolutely wonderful biography, or do you think it happened even earlier than that?
Yeah, so I think Chernow's book was undeniably important for inserting Hamilton back into the consciousness of the academic community and the community of people who really care very deeply about American history. But I think what's happening now with the musical is completely different. Hamilton is at every level now, and it's something I think only a hip-hop musical is capable of, just saturating the American mind.
Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton, and there's a million things I haven't done. Just you wait, just you wait.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Julie Silverbrook, the executive director of an organization called Consource. And today we're talking about one of our favorite American founders, Alexander Hamilton, and how excited we are that he's finally getting his due in American popular culture. In fact, there's even a hip-hop musical about him. That's just so cool. Well, it's that special time of day because I'm looking at Mark across the table. I'm looking at Jen, who's with us here today. Hi, Jen. And, of course, I'm looking at Doug Smith, the quiz guy. I'm guessing we're having a quiz now, aren't we, Doug?
We are having a quiz. It's so good to see you.
It's always a pleasure to see you. It's nice. It kind of gives me a warm fuzzy.
Mm. Good.
All right. Do we have a contestant on the line?
Yes.
Who is this?
This is Sarah from College Station, Texas.
Sarah from College Station, Texas. We are actually broadcast on KAMU. I think it's KAMU2 in College Station, Texas. So what a thrill. What a thrill to have you on with us. And Doug, do you have a quiz for Sarah?
I do. Who doesn't love Texas? All that barbecue?
Everybody loves Texas, I'm sure. But don't mess with them.
Seguin? Seguin, Texas. Beautiful area.
I've never been.
All right, Sarah, are you ready? I'm going to ask you a question and give you four choices.
Yes, sir.
Sarah, whose notes of the debate from the Constitutional Convention of 1787 are regarded as the most authoritative? Whose notes of the debate from the Constitutional Convention of 1787 are regarded as the most authoritative? Is it A, Robert Yates, B, Robert Gates. C, Thomas Jefferson. Or D, James Madison.
So who had the most, who took the best notes?
Who has the most authoritative, who can generally considered the most authoritative notes
the
of the
notes
debate?
Of the
is it
debate.
Is it Robert Yates?
Hmm?
A, B, Robert Gates. C, Thomas Jefferson. Or D, James Madison.
Okay, Sarah, do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't feel like the Robert Gates is the right answer.
Mm-hmm. So it must be Robert Yates, right?
Maybe.
Maybe? Okay. Okay, well.
James Madison with Marbury versus Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson's
always
in there, too. Come on.
Always a winner.
You're stalling, Sarah. Come on.
You got to make a choice here. So, Robert Yates.
Yeah. Then? Of those four guys, who's the best note taker? Who was at the convention and took the best notes?
Then Thomas Jefferson.
You think Thomas Jefferson would be the best note taker?
I don't actually know, so I'm guessing. So... yes.
So you're going to go with C, Thomas Jefferson.
Sure.
Final answer.
Yes.
All right. Doug?
Sarah, I'm afraid you got that one wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thomas Jefferson, he was literate. He could write, but he was absent. He wasn't even at the
Sarah, I have to apologize. Doug set a trap for you because we're always confronted around here. Everybody who works or is associated with Montpelier was the fact that people misattribute a lot of constitutional credit to Thomas Jefferson. And Doug, I think, is making a point here, aren't you?
You know, I have to say, so for our legions of listeners across the country, if you ever hear Thomas Jefferson as an answer, it will not be it.
Except if it's a bad answer.
So Jefferson was at France at the time during the convention.
He was, yes.
So he really didn't participate in the convention. He and James Madison, they sent some letters back and forth. But generally speaking, you know, Jefferson had nearly nothing to do with the Constitution, and certainly wasn't at the convention. Now, Robert Yates was.
He was.
At the convention, and he had notes of the debate.
Right.
At the convention, but they're not considered to be really the
Well, they couldn't really be because he and Lansing, the other delegate from New York, they left early because New York really turned into an anti-federalist state. Isn't that strange? They had three people there from New York.
Mm-hmm.
One of them's Hamilton, who's like the biggest federalist guy there other than Madison, but then Yates and Lansing, I don't think the three of them got along. I don't think they were buds.
Yeah, there's a lot in that room that didn't get along.
I'm afraid that's true. But he did have notes. Yates did.
He did.
So that was a valuable answer. But ultimately, Madison is almost considered definitive.
Oh, yeah, without question. Yeah. And there's actually a new book out by Mary Sarah Bilder about Madison's notes. And so I haven't had a chance to read it, so I'm not endorsing it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say is... there is some great scholarship happening now on Madison's notes. And in fact, if you're interested in the notes, you can go to context.montpelier.org.
Yes, you can.
And actually read the notes of the debate and engage in a conversation. You can kind of crowdsource them. If you're that geeky, which I hope you are.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, Montpelier itself is where Madison, assisted by Dolly, revised, edited, and ultimately published his notes.
Yep. So published posthumously.
Yes, of course. They had to wait till everybody was dead. That was the agreement. But since he was the last guy, that kind of worked out for him.
The last guy standing.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Tremendous. Well, Sarah, don't feel bad about missing this one because I think Doug was aiming to get you on that one. And we appreciate your playing and being a good sport.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet. It's the art.
It's one of those Constitution things.
It is.
And you read it for the articles.
Yeah.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Julie Silverbrook, the executive director of Consource, all about one of our favorite founders, Alexander Hamilton. And just before the break, Julie mentioned something that makes me green with envy. That is that she got to see the off-Broadway, then the off-Broadway musical Hamilton, which of course now is a huge smash hit on Broadway. And one of the interesting aspects of this show is that it's very factual. Indeed, it's based very closely upon a well-respected biography that came out about 10 years ago by a fellow named Ron Chernow.
Now, I read this biography of Chernow probably a year or two after it came out, maybe 2007 or so. Had a great time and was so impressed by it that I thought to myself, this would make a marvelous play. And in fact, I even came up with a concept. I thought to myself, well, you know, you could have Hamilton lying on his deathbed after, you know, he was rowed back across the Hudson River, and he's lying there. He was there for something like 30 hours. After he was injured, mortally wounded in his duel, and you could have a series of flashbacks, and you could go over all the things he did in his life, and wouldn't that be great? Yeah, okay, that's a nice, staid, traditional concept, but somebody else read that book and came up with a much better and more remarkable concept. Who was the fellow who came up with a concept for this hip-hop Broadway musical?
So his name is Lin Manuel Miranda, and the musical is based on Chernow's book, and he was consulted throughout the development of the musical.
And I wonder how in the world this guy came up with this idea that you could have a hip-hop musical about Alexander Hamilton.
He's a creative genius, and he's been justly recognized as such. In fact, I believe he was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant this past year, just to recognize the contributions he's making to historical understanding.
Mm-hmm. That's the difference between me and somebody who gets a genius grant, is they inject the hip hop into it.
You know, it's actually a genius way, truthfully, of delivering lines musically where you have so much content to get out. So I've seen a number of historical musicals, large and small.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen just at the Kennedy Center, there was Appomattox, which was an opera. It was pleasant, but musically difficult to listen to, because opera, you kind of elongate, you know, the notes and the words. And so it was very difficult to get all of the dialogue out through that musical format. With hip hop, it's rapid fire. That's the way that the genre works. So it's a really perfect way to get a lot of dialogue out in a way that sounds good to the ear.
Yes, and I've heard, and I'm ashamed to admit that I've yet to see the Hamilton musical, and I must get over to New York and I must see it, or maybe I'll see a touring company before too long. At any rate, everything I've read about it says that it really does contain a huge amount of content.
It does, yeah.
But it's, that it comes very rapidly. Now, were you able to follow it? First of all, where did you see it? Did you see it on Broadway?
I did not. I saw it when it was off Broadway. So it was actually slightly longer. The show was slightly longer at that time than it is now for the Broadway format. It's useful to go in knowing about Hamilton's background. With that said, I think you can go in knowing nothing and completely follow along. It doesn't move so quickly that you can't follow what's happening. And a lot of the themes of Hamilton's life, you know, being this immigrant who comes and rises so high, but sort of falls very quickly at the end of his life. And this question of what might have been, you know, could Alexander Hamilton have been president? What would have been had he not been killed in that duel? So there's a lot of repeating of themes, and that for the uninitiated is a good way of reinforcing information about Hamilton.
Yeah, and there are several things, of course, in Chernow's book and in others, I'm sure, as well, that talk about some very, very important things about Hamilton. He was dirt poor. He, as you have already pointed out, was an orphan. He was completely a self-made man. He was a person who grew up, I don't know if we've mentioned this yet, on the island of Nevis in the British West Indies.
Yep.
The counting house that you mentioned he worked in was a counting house that dealt, among other things, in slaves. I mean, this the Caribbean slave trade and the Caribbean slavery was perhaps the worst part of a horrible institution. And one of the reasons there was a continuing demand for a slave trade is because so many of the slaves who were brought over from West Africa were worked to death in horrible, horrible conditions. And from a very early age, although Hamilton was forced by necessity to, in some sense, participate in this, he abhorred slavery.
That's right. And in fact, he never owned slaves and was involved in a manumission society for freeing slaves, which makes him unique amongst the founding generation, as you mentioned, for many reasons, given his background, but also for that.
Well, he had seen slavery at its worst, and he'd been appalled by it. And so when he had the opportunity, he declared himself inalterably opposed to it. That was way ahead of his time. I think it's consistent also with his more general revolutionary and subsequently his Federalist perspective that he was very much in favor of rights, individual rights, the rights of Englishmen, as they were called at that time. But he was not in favor of what was then denigrated as democracy.
That's right. So that's a common theme for much of the founding generation, that what we would call direct democracy would be hectic and would lead to the downfall of society, and that you didn't want to be ruled by the mob. It was the common sense at the time. And as you alluded to, Hamilton was a proponent of strong national government.
Yes, he was. One particular incident, and I'll ask you this, whether it appeared or was featured in the musical, that always struck in my mind was that although Hamilton himself very quickly joined the revolutionary cause when he was a student at what was then King's College, later Columbia, he did not like the excesses. He did not like these young men who would go to taverns and get drunk and then would go out and tar and feather loyalists. And in fact, on one very notable occasion, he stood in the doorway of the home of the president of King's College, a notable loyalist, and prevented a mob from assaulting that man, allowing, in fact, the president of King's College to escape at great personal risk because, again, he was part of the revolutionary cause, but he did not think that it was something that should be run by the mob.
So that particular scene is not depicted.
Oh, now see, that really irritates me. It really should have been.
Or at least in the pre-Broadway version,
right.
It was not a part of it. But his discomfort with the excess of other individuals his age who were involved in the Revolutionary War certainly is a topic that's covered during the show.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that musical that I haven't seen. What did it emphasize, if not that pivotal moment at King's College?
Yeah, so it really emphasizes that Hamilton feels that he has this limited amount of time. That's why he, you know, gets involved in politics at a relatively young age, you know, joins the colonial army, fights in the Revolutionary War, works with Washington, although is always itching when he's working for Washington to get back to the battlefield. They talk about this plays a real central role, his courtship and marriage to Elizabeth Schuyler, who was the daughter of a very powerful New York landholder and military officer. They talk about their marriage, which was largely a happy marriage, but suffered later on from Hamilton's infidelity. Which also impacts him politically. And so that episode is covered in detail in the Broadway musical.
Well, let's talk about that. That's a little bit salacious, but it's often overlooked. The Mariah Reynolds affair, how do they handle that in the musical?
Yep. Its significance Hamilton, the political creature, is that Mariah Reynolds' husband tries to link Hamilton to a scheme to illegally manipulate federal securities, and Hamilton, to prove his innocence, actually publishes the love letters that he had written to Mariah in order to clear his name of the financial impropriety, which is mind-boggling today, right?
It's absolutely mind-boggling. So I'm going to back up and go over this again. Hamilton is the first Treasury Secretary. Is often credited, as you've already said, with saving us from utter bankruptcy in the 1790s. He does absolutely astonishing, marvelous, wonderful things at the Treasury Department. But while he's there, while he's in this tiny little brick building, which one can still see in Philadelphia, it's still standing, one day this young woman, and I think at this point Hamilton's at least in his 30s, maybe in his 40s, this young woman, and she's in her early 20s, shows up and simply asks for his assistance. She says she's got an abusive husband. She wants to go home to her family. She doesn't have any money. Can he please help her? He says, sure, I'll help you out. But his chivalry is then repaid in other than monetary terms. And then at that point, affair begins. And this happens when his wife Elizabeth is off in Albany, where her family lives, and it continues for some period of time. And of course, this is a scandal. It's a scandal today, just as it would be back then. But Hamilton's concern is not so much with the romantic scandal, but with the suggestion that Mariah Reynolds' husband has somehow condoned this relationship and has somehow either cooperated with Hamilton or blackmailed Hamilton to gain some sort of advantage with regard to trade in government securities, which, of course, Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, would oversee. And that's when he's confronted with the scandal, he publishes this pamphlet. I mean, and he basically admits everything and goes into great detail about all the salacious details.
That's right. all in the name of clearing himself of financial impropriety, really governmental impropriety. And, you know, this is clearly something that took its toll on his marriage and on his wife. But it speaks to... first of all, how important reputation was to the founding generation, particularly with regard to the legacy that they were building for American government and for the American financial system. And so it was really fundamental for Hamilton for that aspect of his life, which was just a huge part of his life, to have no... black mark on it. He had to be cleared in that regard, and really did something extraordinary for a politician to not only come clean but to publish the evidence, private love letters, is really quite extraordinary.
New York City.
Pardon me, are you Aaron Burr, sir?
That depends. Who's asking?
Oh, well, sure. Sir, I'm Alexander Hamilton. I'm at your service, sir. I have been looking for you.
I'm getting nervous.
Sir, I heard your name at Princeton. I was seeking an accelerated course of study when I got sort of out of sorts with a buddy of yours. I may have punched him. It's a blur, sir. He handles the financials.
You punched the bursar.
Yes, I wanted to do what you did, graduating to enjoy...
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Julie Silverbrook, the executive director of Consource and a fellow fan of Alexander Hamilton. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Julie Silverbrook. Stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Now it's time to finish my discussion with Julie Silverbrook, the executive director of Consource, all about, we're both, I was about to say fanboys, but I guess she's a fangirl of Alexander Hamilton, one of the most underappreciated of American founders. There are probably a number of reasons why that's true, perhaps most notably that he died young at the age of 49 in that notorious duel with Aaron Burr. But even before that, as Julie was just telling me, he had pretty much destroyed his own political career, first by having an affair with a much younger woman, and then secondly by writing and publishing a pamphlet all about it. That's something Julie calls extraordinary.
Extraordinary is itself an extraordinary word. But what it really emphasizes is that he really saw a distinction between what's commonly called private morality, where he clearly screwed up, and public morality. And his argument was essentially, yeah, guys, you're right. I did this. I shouldn't have. I cheated on my wife. I'm sorry. Here are the details. But this never, ever crossed the line into affecting my public decisions. And the interesting thing is that some years later, when the opposing party, the Jeffersonians, the Democratic Republicans, got into power, they actually audited all of the Treasury Department, and their Treasury Secretary, a fellow by the name of Gallatin, a Frenchman, or fellow who emigrated from France, eventually said, yeah, Hamilton was right. It never, ever affected his public morality.
And the very interesting thing is at the Treasury Department here in Washington, D.C., a very snowy place today, on one side of the Treasury Department is Albert Gallatin, and on the other side is a statue of Alexander Hamilton.
Two very important dudes. Anything else about the musical before we go on to another subject that involving Hamilton?
Yeah, I think something that's really great is some of the educational aspects of not only the show, but some extra things that are happening. So the Rockefeller Foundation, in partnership with the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History and the New York City Department of Education, are going to provide 20,000 free tickets to the musical for New York City high school students.
That's very cool.
Very, very cool. The program will launch in April of this year, and it will bring students to select afternoon matinees, which will include talkbacks with the cast, as well as some classroom materials, and several other history and civic education groups are joining in on the fun. Mount Vernon, which is George Washington's home, recently released a bundle of resources related to the songs in the Broadway show. Other organizations like Consource are also working on initiatives to celebrate Hamilton's contributions to America. So there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening. And I think some of this stuff would have happened either way, but it certainly wouldn't be happening at this exact moment in time if it were not for the musical.
That's absolutely marvelous. Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you mentioned Mount Vernon, and of course that's Washington's home, and Washington and Hamilton were very, very close. In fact, that's probably the closest Washington ever had to a father-son arrangement, and Hamilton probably too, since he didn't really know his father. But Hamilton had his own home. Have you ever been up to his home in New York City called The Grange?
The Grange, I have.
You have? You're like the only other person I've ever talked to who has.
I've also been to Trinity Church Cemetery in New York, where you can find Alexander Hamilton's final resting place. And I have been to the spot in Weehawken, New Jersey, where he was fatally wounded in his duel with Aaron Burr.
Okay, now you're just showing off, Julie, because
I'm a little bit of an American history, tourist. So I like to visit these historic sites. The great thing about all of this is that there have been investments made to preserve these historic sites. And so, folks, when you go to New York and you're hoping to win a ticket in the lottery that they do for the show, or you're waiting in line, also think about going to these great historic sites and seeing where Hamilton lived, where he was when he was fatally wounded, where he walked, where he's buried, and support the work of the groups that are working to preserve all of these sites for posterity.
Absolutely. 100% agree. I'm going to ask you about two of those three sites that I have not seen. But first, I'll comment about the Grange. When I saw the Grange, it was in terrible shape. It was turned sideways on a street where it was almost indistinguishable from all the houses that were around it. It was a terrible shadow of its former self. It was horribly neglected. This was about, 10 years ago or so when I was in town. Well, actually, it was 2003, which was the 200th anniversary of the duel, and the New York Historical Society had a marvelous, marvelous exhibition on Hamilton. And I went up and visited the Grange, and it was in sorry, sorry shape. But I'm very pleased to say that in a very short period of time after that, and in fact, plans were already underway in 03, it was moved from that site to a nearby park, which, although not exactly where it was located in all those years ago, is in some sense more similar to where it was. Is that when you saw it? Have you seen it since it was moved to the park?
I have, yes.
Okay.
And a lot of work has gone into restoring the home. And so if you did see it when it was in disrepair, and really all of the, at least many of the presidential homes and many other historic homes sort of had to suffer through this period of disrepair and then restoration, I highly recommend going back and checking it out now.
Great. It's up in Harlem, Harlem Heights, actually, and that was where Hamilton was. I mean, he picked this marvelous place that used to have marvelous vistas. I think he could see both the East River and the Hudson River from his home.
You'd pay a pretty penny for that in New York today.
I think you do, and that's probably, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's too bad that we can't go back there and just recreate that. As you know, there are very few homes, presidential homes like Montpelier, where it's virtually unchanged since the day, even though, of course, Montpelier had to undergo a major restoration. But at least the viewscape, as it's often called, is more or less unchanged in that time. And Hamilton, of course, will never get that back. Nonetheless, I'm so very, very pleased to hear that. And that's one marvelous place, but you also mentioned Trinity Church, his resting place. That's worth a visit, isn't it?
Yes, it's a pretty grand tomb. He's in, and you see it, you know, it says Alexander Hamilton and his date of birth and date of death. And there's an organization called the Alexander Hamilton Awareness Society that does a big birthday celebration. And Hamilton's birthday is on January 11th, so we're just a couple of days past that now.
Mm-hmm.
And they started them, and I participated 2 years ago, I think. They started the Museum of American Finance on Wall Street, go down Wall Street to Trinity Church Cemetery, look at where Hamilton is buried. They have discussions, and then they go out to Weehawken, New Jersey, at the site of the famous duel.
I mean, that's what I want to really hear. That's what I want to hear about next. Is I've never been there. Tell me about going to Weehawken.
I say this having a brother who lives in Weehawken. I think it's the most interesting part of Weehawken, New Jersey.
I'm not aware of anything else for which Weehawken is particularly known.
This is something that Weehawken has sort of worked to preserve and mark the dueling grounds. So you see the Hudson River, so you can imagine them sneaking across the Hudson River to engage in the duel. And so you'll see a statue marking where Hamilton, of course, was fatally wounded. So it's worth going over to Weehawken. I mean, there are a couple of restaurants over there if you wanted to grab a meal and enjoy. The great thing about Weehawken beyond the historical marker where the duel happened is the incredible view of modern Manhattan that you can only get by being across the Hudson and not in the downtown area.
Oh, absolutely. The best views of Manhattan are probably from New Jersey, some of the heights over there. The $10 bill. I mean, I am very, very concerned about recent suggestions that somehow Alexander Hamilton should be removed from the $10 bill. And let me say, before we go any further, I'm a feminist. You're a feminist. I know you're a feminist.
Undeniably.
And I think it's fair to say that both of us are unequivocally in favor of recognizing prominent women in history and perhaps memorializing them on currency. The suggestion is, however, that some woman should be selected to replace Alexander Hamilton, and this just completely upsets me. How about you?
When the news was first announced, this was right at the point where the Broadway show was really taking off and people were really pro-Hamilton. And then the Treasury Department announced that it was going to be redesigning the $10 bill. And that would mean either the removal of Alexander Hamilton or what now appears it will be just Hamilton being on the bill in a diminished role, which would also allow for a woman to be on the $10 bill as well. There was some questions as to why the $10 bill. There was a movement started by a group called Women on 20s. And
yeah.
The goal was to actually remove Andrew Jackson, our controversial seventh president, who, as you know, opposed both the central bank and paper money, of which Hamilton was the champion.
Yeah, look, on that basis alone, look, there are lots of things. In fact, Andrew Jackson is somebody I really want to talk about on the show. I mean, you want to talk about somebody who's got a very mixed sort of reputation, and that's a story for another day. But on that basis alone, I mean, for heaven's sake, Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury, saved us financially, and then Andrew Jackson on the 20, who was against
right.
almost everything that is represented by paper money.
So the thought of this group was we ought to have a woman on a note of currency to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which
There's
is coming
that.
Up.
Yeah.
And the Treasury Department has a schedule for changing the design of American currency. And I actually went to a public talk that Rosie Rios, who is the treasurer of the United States, gave at the Sewell Belmont House, which is a museum here in Washington to commemorate women's suffrage. She gave a public talk and explained why the $10 bill and not the $20 bill was selected. And it has to do with the schedule for changing the design of currency, and that's based on preventing the counterfeiting of dollars. So the $10 bill was what was next in line for redesign, and they can't change the order because
okay.
Right.
There's a whole
explanation that they gave as to why the $10 bill. Now, you know, personally for me, what they're proposing is that a woman, for the first time in 119 some odd years, would A, have to share a note of currency, right? Because they're not going to remove Hamilton altogether. And so this is both, in my mind, disrespectful to whoever they choose as the historic woman figure, be it Abigail Adams, Harriet Tubman, whomever they choose. And is also, in my mind, disrespectful to Alexander Hamilton. Of course, this decision is solely in the discretion of our current Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew. And I think there was a news release that went out in early January that he's moving forward as planned
with
the redesign of the $10 bill.
That just sounds like a bunch of bureaucratic nonsense to me. I mean, I understand schedules. I understand you want new currency that prevents counterfeiting. It's all cool. I understand there's there's a 100th anniversary of women's suffrage coming up in 2020, and that's a great date to do it. But don't diss Alexander Hamilton, and as you say, don't diss women by, you know, giving them half a bill. You know, if it just announce now that it's going to be the 20, and if it takes a few extra years, well then so be it. But announce now that it's going to be the 20, and then it's going to be all women all over the 20, and that's it.
So I agree with you, and the Treasury Department, I think in part because there was such a large public outcry about Hamilton's removal now, you know, his diminished role, and eventual phasing out on the $10 bill. You know, they tried to explain this. I think passions still run high on the topic. People are still upset about it. And the only way around it is for Congress to pass a law regulating the currency. So there are a couple of laws that regulate who can be on notes of currency. One is that no living person can appear on a bill, and the other is that George Washington must always remain on the $1
okay, that's cool.
Bill. But, you know, of course, you know, if this is something that Congress wanted to take up, it certainly could. But as of right now, there's no regulation that would protect Hamilton, because, like I said, it's fully within the discretion of the Secretary of the Treasury.
Jack Lew. Okay, Jack Lew, you're on my list. And I think that people need to figure out what his email address is and email him. This is not over yet. He can make as many announcements as he wants. This is not over yet. This would just be wrong. This is the year of Ham the Man. Any final thoughts before we finish this up, Julie?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would love to see all of the founding fathers have their day on Broadway, to have their moment in the sun. I'm so glad that it's Hamilton. I think he has an incredible life story. Being, you know, the illegitimate son of a French woman who was living in the West Indies, who immigrated to the United States and did amazing things for himself and for the country, is an incredible story. I encourage everyone, if they can, to at least buy the soundtrack to the Hamilton musical. Try to get tickets if they can. It's a tough ticket to get. And definitely read Chernow's biography. And also, there are other really great books about Hamilton out there. So, you know, go check it out. Go to the Grange, go to the Dueling Grounds, check out his tomb at Trinity Church, and just celebrate all of the founding fathers. Use this as an opportunity to remember how extraordinary they were in both their personal lives and their public lives.
Julie Silberbrook of Consource, I could not have said it better. Thank you so much for sharing all this marvelous knowledge about Ham the Man.
Thanks so much, Stuart. You have a good one.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain.
Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Julie Silberbrook, the executive director of Consource. It's a marvelous organization. You can find it at consource.org. That's consource.org. It's a very worthy charitable organization, so get on there and give them all kinds of money and help protect our constitutional history. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell, by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, and Alexander Hamilton expects you to live up to that legacy.